Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And this is Greenhorns Radio, and we are having another episode of Greenhorns Radio today with Nathan McClintock, who I was at Berkeley with almost 8 years ago, and now he's a teacher of many things and a PhD man, and is writing on topics of interest to many of us who are involved in urban and peri-urban agriculture. Welcome to the show, Nathan.
Thanks, Severin. It's great to hear your voice again.
It's great to hear your voice again. Could you mind introducing yourself briefly about what you're focused on these days?
Sure. So I'm Nathan McClintock. I'm an assistant professor at Portland State University in Portland, Oregon. I'm in the Toulon School of Urban Studies and Planning, and I received my PhD in geography from UC Berkeley in 2011, so I've been here about 2 years now. My research is primarily on urban agriculture and food systems. My dissertation work was conducted in Oakland. I was looking at urban agriculture, both the movement sort of from historical terms and what went into the rise of urban agriculture, the very vibrant urban agriculture movement in Oakland. And I know you've had several people from the Oakland urban ag movement on your show already. So kind of a historical perspective on that, but then also really engaging with kind of participatory research methods, integrating my research into the needs of a few different food systems, and food justice organizations in Oakland. So that would have been the Hope Collaborative and also the Oakland Food Policy Council. So I really drew a lot of the questions for my research based on their needs. So one of the needs was, you know, how much vacant land is there in Oakland? Where is it located? How much food could we potentially grow from it? And then a second question that came up from that work was, to what extent is that, to what extent is that land contaminated with lead? And then the third question was, to what extent do existing zoning and land use regulations actually prohibit urban agriculture? So that was sort of the focus of my work at Berkeley. And then now at Portland, I've been shifting my focus to be focused more locally on what's going on in Portland. But what I'm pretty interested in now is really looking at how urban agriculture, particularly in a place like Oakland, that is very renowned for its sustainability successes, how a lot of these successes are really kind of focused solely on kind of environmental sustainability, and questions of social sustainability are often left out of the equation. So my real concern now is, how do we make urban agriculture something that's actually resonating with and benefiting all of the population, not just sort of a kind of affluent, eco-minded, predominantly white population? And so I've been actually mapping residential urban agriculture in Oakland, and you see massive concentrations in a particular part of the city, which is really the kind of part of the city that's celebrated and made fun of on the TV show Portlandia, so the sort of sustainable Portland. But if you go out to eastern Portland, East Portland, it's much more low income out there, and you really don't see the urban agriculture there that you see in part of the city.
So this is, you're pointing to this irony that well-meaning white kids travel to blighted neighborhoods, clean up glass with their fingers, and they initiate a successional economic process that result in the people who are surrounding that plot of now improved land face gentrification and displacement, much to the chagrin of aforementioned well-intentioned
right.
white kids.
Yeah, so what I don't want to do is establish causality, because I think, you know, gentrification is a much more complicated process than that. And so there's, especially in Oakland, there's been a big tension about that, you know, saying that urban agriculture causes gentrification, and it doesn't. I don't say that at all. It's one of a suite of, I would say urban agriculture is a practice that is embraced by a population that, you know, by a new arriving population in, you know, gentrifying neighborhoods. And so, you know, it's a practice that many gentrifiers engage in. It is not what causes gentrification. And so even though there is data showing that, you know, gardens lead to increases in property value, et cetera, the actual processes leading to gentrification are much more large than just, you know, the whatever, the 20 or 50 people coming in and practicing urban agriculture. It's about, you know, real estate markets. It's about all of that. Absolutely, that urban agriculture and, you know, a vibrant food movement in a neighborhood contributes to that increasing desirability in a property, you know, and a neighborhood as being an amenity. So I would say it contributes to it, but I definitely don't want to make the claim that it causes it at all.
I think that making the point of including a consideration of the social outcomes of one's work is a really positive perspective to bring into the physical direct action of establishing a garden or a farm. Mm-hmm. And a prerequisite to long-term success is thinking in the context of, you know, all the broad number of impacts that initiation will ignite.
Yeah.
So I wasn't trying to box you into a causality. I'm more trying to open up the conversation, but I think deserves much more opening, and I'm really glad you're opening it. The question that immediately springs to my mind is how do you act as a gardener, as an urban farmer? What are the ways, what are the models that you can point to as a researcher of appropriate tactics?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to, and, you know, I teach a couple of classes that we tackle this. I have a small, like, capstone-based class of 15 students. It's just called Urban Agriculture and Food Systems. And, you know, so we talk about this there, and then I also teach a participatory research methods for community development class. And in both of those classes, we start out just kind of with some sort of basic understanding of privilege and what we call positionality. So, you know, where are we coming from? What is our what is our position of power? What power do we actually hold that other people may or may not hold? So really kind of trying to map that power and our position. So I think that's a key first step, is really sort of recognizing where we, you know, how we actually wield our power knowingly or unknowingly. Often in the food movement, you know, there's sort of a colonialist mentality, well-meaning, but I think naive and also ultimately kind of oppressive, which is that we just need, you know, if they just knew what to eat, or if we just take this garden into this neighborhood, then they'll eat healthy. And it's very much sort of an imposing kind of mentality that sort of recreates this notion that we know better than them. And I think that's a really dangerous line to tread. And so that's something I think that's a really important first key, is to look reflexively at ourselves and how we speak about things and the language that we use, to make sure that we're not actually propagating and perpetuating old, long-standing kind of racist and classist forms of oppression through our work. So that's, we actually, you know, last year we had a workshop series. It was about 8-week workshop series that some students and I put on for food systems activists here in Portland, to really kind of do this anti-oppression type training, to really kind of think about, well, you know, where in our language are we actually sort of perpetuating this idea? So I think a lot of the work has to be personal work, and really kind of identifying and understanding privilege. And organizations like People's Grocery in Oakland have done a really good job offering kind of anti-oppression trainings and having their volunteers go through that. So I think, and I'm sure throughout the country there are other good examples of that. You know, there's the Growing Food and Justice conference every year up in Growing Power puts on. So that's a good example of a place to learn some of those skills. So I think that sort of interpersonal work is really important. And then I think the second piece, like once you're actually wanting to get on the ground, a really important piece is identifying existing organizations that perhaps are not celebrated, that haven't received the same type of press, and having them, you know, really sort of seeing what they're doing and then, you know, kind of going to offering oneself as an ally rather than someone with a solution who's going to just go in and say, here's what we're going to do, and really, you know, trying to partner. Sometimes they may or may not be interested in food or urban agriculture, so what are they working on? You know, maybe food is something that they're interested in working on, but they haven't developed yet. So, like, what language are they using to connect with the community? So I think that's a key piece. Someone who you might want to have on your show at some point who's done some really interesting work on this is Kristen Reynolds, who's a postdoc at the New School. And she and Nevin Cohen are writing a book called Beyond the Kale, and it's about New York City. And it's really kind of about the racialization of the urban agriculture movement in New York, how, you know, all like the New York Magazine and New York Times, they show these pictures of like, here's the new urban farmer. And, you know, it's usually a white person in their 20s. But what that's doing is obscuring, you know, decades-old tradition of people of color activists working and growing food in East, you know, East New York and in Brooklyn and, you know, Bed-Stuy, places like that, who, you know, struggle to get a grant for $200, whereas these sort of young new farmers are, you know, landing these $300,000, $500,000 grants to, you know, to build a rooftop farm, et cetera. So it's a really interesting story, and I think, you know, it's really important that the story of the original sort of urban farmers be told, so that, you know, they actually kind of reap the benefits of this sort of new wave of urban agriculture interest.
Well, as a key promoter of young white people in agriculture, I feel like,
yeah, I'm here to push some buttons today.
No, it's good. You know, I think that part of this reason for the success of that image in the press has to do with it being a weird juxtaposition of privilege and at the bottom, privilege inserting itself at the bottom of the economy, and
yeah. Mm-hmm.
This kind of like our economy, our cultural norms are that people who go to college don't dig in the ground. And so
mm-hmm.
I feel like the like next cool move we could make is to say, you know, people who could be privileged, you know, and exempt themselves from good behavior and working in the context of an ecosystem of forces in coalition with other interest groups and in respect of history and in respect of their own power, are, you know,
mm-hmm.
are working together with people of other backgrounds. That would be, like, the next pitch we have to make is,
yeah.
Look, this is a weird thing. People working together, you know.
Yeah.
Let's sell this new idea of working together to improve the lives of our communities. So I see it as a challenge for... not to get hung up on, you know, white kids get all the fun jujubes, although that's an easy place for resentment to catch in terms of,
mm-hmm.
like, if the dirt is sliding across the floor, that's an easy reel for it to catch on.
Mm-hmm.
And instead to take responsibility within our movement to educate our young people to move in ways appropriate to long-term success. So I feel
absolutely. I mean, I think that kind of alliance building is really crucial, and I think it's a really important, you know, maneuver. I think it's, again, I think it's important to sort of underscore that it's not that this hasn't been done kind of maliciously, and it's often only in retrospect that we realize the how things could have been done better. So in recognizing ways to improve, that's then that puts the onus of responsibility on ourselves to actually make those changes and to reach out and make those connections and establish those types of contacts.
Well, and I think this is echoed in the conservation movement with second and third wave conservationists.
Absolutely. Yeah, with basically the recognition of the environmental justice movement. Those issues weren't around or recognized in mainstream sort of environmental discourse in the 60s, but now they are in much more of a way, and they have resonated precisely because of alliance building, so that the power and wealth of white environmental groups was able to connect and articulate with the on-the-ground actions of environmental justice movements of color that didn't have the same economic power, basically, to have their voice heard.
Well, and so then moving into the kind of how and the wherefore, there's two different little threads that are coming loose from my sweater right now. One of them is around technology, and a lot of your work has been about mapping the potential for urban and peri-urban agriculture and trying to evaluate the territory using this incredible tool that we now have. Can you talk a little bit about how mapping technologies... Well, so that was one thread, and then the other thread was how the next set of tools, it seems to me, as we, are growing the awareness and literacy within the urban farming community about these structural empowerment issues, are tools of finance and new economic tools to make access for capitalization a more democratic process and a more kind of community accessible process than this everything goes to the winner model that seems to predominate in our economy in general.
Right. Well, I can't speak too much to I can't speak too much to the success. To possibilities for financing, other than just saying I'm an unabashed proponent of worker cooperatives. As a means of sort of sharing, as a means of sharing the means of production and actually reducing some of those types of initial startup costs. In terms of where to actually access those funds, I'm not the person to talk to about that. I think there are some models such as community land trusts, agricultural land trusts, particularly in conjunction with worker type cooperatives, whether we're just specifically talking about production, or are we talking about transformation or the CSA model or whatever, I think that they're very different kind of models that are obviously counter the sort of typical market logic. And I think whatever we can do to promote those and to tell important stories and identify case studies of those successes is really important. When it comes to mapping, I can speak a little bit more about that. I think it's kind of a double-edged sword. On one hand, I think it's really important to map potential, and it's really important kind of to identify, my first mapping project was, identifying this vacant land in Oakland. We call it cultivating the commons because we were just looking at publicly owned land. And so identifying those spaces as commons and sort of trying to reclaim that notion of the commons, back from the sort of days before, capitalist enclosement of the land. I think mapping the commons, even if it's an unrealistic exercise, even if you don't think that, even if we identified 1,200 acres in Oakland and 800 of which were on land that wasn't too steep, obviously all 800 of those acres we would never really conceive of as being farmed. But I think it's important just to sort of think about what are the limits of the possibilities, and then we can sort of be more pragmatic about it as well. So then, in the study that came out later where we sort of crunched some numbers. We said, okay, well, what would it look like if 500 of these acres were transferred as into production, or what about 100 of these acres? And so, you know, I think it's an important first step to kind of map that potential, you know, vision. It's just kind of like a visioning process. So I think there's a lot of really important work that comes out of that visioning process. And, you know, I think it's also a way that researchers who have or you know, tech geeks or whatever, and it's not that hard to do. It's not that hard to learn, and then there are freeware GIS programs like QGIS, Quantum GIS, you know, that you can teach yourself, that you can download for free. You know, I think it's a way that people who have time and kind of techno interests can contribute to a local movement. So now, you know, when I did that study, there were, I think, only three others. There was Portland, Seattle, and Vancouver. They'd done that. But, you know, now there's 20, 30 different, 40 different cities have done land inventories. And so I think it's a really kind of important first step. The flip side, I said it was a double-edged sword, because I think the flip side is that mapping has always had a colonial, I mean, to go back to this kind of concept of colonialism, there's always been a colonialist aspect to mapping. I mean, the first cartographers and geographers were really stewards of empire, right? They were empire builders, and they were trying to, like, put, you know, name things. They were trying to create legible subjects.
They were conquistadors.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, trying to locate places and put them on a map so that those places could be claimed and exploited. And so there's always that danger. So I think, you know, who's doing the mapping, to what ends, is always really important. But then ultimately, here's where the double-edged sword lies, is who ultimately profits from the knowledge. You know, I got a bunch of calls after that first thing came out from these kind of entrepreneurial types who probably didn't have too much vested interest in Oakland or the people of Oakland, but were really just kind of looking for cheap land. And I really actually, you know, I sort of did a double take, and I actually went back and added some much stronger language in the intro and the conclusion, and sort of reissued the report, because I wanted to make it very clear the importance of, you know, kind of doing this in a participatory way that really involves, you know, community benefits and rather than stewarding land grabs, you know. So that's the negative side of the double edge that I think people have to keep in mind when they think about mapping, is who's using the data and the information.
We had a similar situation here in the Adirondack Park where the new NRCS guy was like, oh, I can use these cool GIS tools to map the best farmland in the county and co-associate it with the owner list. And lo and behold, 3 months later, all of the best land was ripped out of grass and turned into GMO corn for dairy cows by the largest landowner, who had just at that moment also realizing and recognizing that the price of corn and the price of the cheap farmland and the profit potential, and boom, the information was right at their fingertips.
Yeah.
Without having to wade through the kind of protective complexity of landowner negotiations and da 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 da.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we also went through and calculated sort of potential for on private land as well, you know, located about 400, you know, underutilized acres. But I was, yeah, very explicit about, even though that data is out there as to who the landowner is, et cetera, you know, I didn't know the different layers of legality of privacy, and so for me it was really important to make sure that that remained. You know, I didn't want to have any linkages to landowner and privacy information, et cetera.
Well, it's very interesting to keep those
obstacles in the way.
So two different little mapping agriculture tidbits for your hopper there. Number one is in France, the cadastre, which lists landownership, they don't have, as we have in the U.S., a map, a public map of soil quality. For the very reason that landowners don't want the quality of their land to be publicly known. Another interesting thing is that as Monsanto is now announcing its plans to partner, quote-unquote partner, with farmers in gathering data about every square inch of their soil, productive capacity, dissolved nitrogen, yield potential, compaction, dot, 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 you know, down to a very small granular, on a very small or high level of detail based on data collected by the equipment itself as it goes through the field, harvesting and planting. The Farm Bureau has come out against it, saying, you know, you're giving these mega corporations the tools to game the system in their favor, mm-hmm. and let's not do that.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very hot and interesting discourse, you know, open. We all like open source, but, you know, you don't want to open your home up to being
invaded. Yeah, it's like the NSA thing, right? It's the era of big data, you know, and we can collect it now with the existing technologies. But ultimately, you know, who controls the data, how it's used, is a really important question. I mean, you know, I'm in this urban studies and planning school now, and there's a big debate within urban studies and in planning as well. You know, there's a bunch of sort of tech jockeys who really think that we can model the city with all this data, you know, cell phone data and, you know, transit fare data, you know, from New York subway systems and who's going where when. So we have all this data. But then, you know, the sort of next step in the way people are thinking about it is that, well, we can just, like, run these regression analyses, et cetera, and figure out and essentially model the city, right? And so it's using the data to then produce a model of what one thinks that it should look like. And that's, I think, really where, you know, some of the danger lies as well, is, you know, is trying to sort of project, extrapolate what some ideal looks like just based on this type of data. So GIS and mapping always runs that, you know, you always run that risk. And so, you know, people who use GIS critically, you know, very much discuss the kind of implications of power and how these things are used and who's, and you know, for who.
Well, and I think, I mean, as a bottom line, you know, ultimately our audience here is for new agrarians, is of new agrarians and people who are interested and engaged with the future and contributing to that future in a positive and meaningful way to provide a basic human need, which is food, mm-hmm. and to engage in basic human processes, which are agriculture and community engagement. So it seems like the tools to do that vary in their usage and in their potential, but that we don't have to panic and we don't have to, you know, start treating the city as an operating system or each other as avatars only, or just start,
right.
you know, getting too, like, freaked out. We can just acknowledge that maybe I should let you finish that. We can acknowledge that these technologies are enabling, but are also, they also distort our understanding of how things really work in the real world. Is that a fair?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the risk of losing quantitative, losing kind of qualitative measurements of the way of social relationships. You know, the moment that you start trying to measure social relationships using numbers, you start to have problems, right? You know, it's like we can measure, you know, rates of mineralization of organic nitrogen and sort of optimize rates of compost application, you know, but what does that mean when we're talking about, you know, the you know, where you're getting the compost from in relation to who's producing it, who's providing it, who's shipping it, you know, like who's going to actually flip the bill, whose labor is involved, you know. Maybe the compost thing is running out. Maybe I'm going down the wrong track with that example, but you know, you get my point that we can measure these biophysical aspects, but then to sort of extrapolate from these biophysical quantitative aspects to try to then make decisions that are very much deeply, deeply embedded in social relationships. That's when we have to be really careful, and that's when we have to really study things and speak to people, and you know, that's when all the qualitative research really comes in, and the interviews and talking to people and understanding those relationships and those power structures.
Yeah, you know, lately I've been just feeling like my favorite innovation is traditions.
Mm-hmm.
This is exciting. Let's talk about this more because we have no more time whatsoever. This is another episode of Greenhorns Radio, which should go on for an hour, but only had half an hour. I thank you, Nathan, for being here, and would you be open to taking this up some more?
Sure. Yeah, we'll do it another. Sorry, I have to run. I've got my class in a little bit, so I couldn't stay much longer today. But we'll pick it up again another time.
All righty. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thanks. Take care. Bye bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.